This hour of the Jason Rand Show is brought to you by You Build It. Lots of news is happening all around the world and right here at home. So, let's find out what's trending.
What's trending? National.
So, President Trump is going to announce his pick to the Supreme Court on Saturday at 2 p.m. our time. That is the latest coming from the president's campaign. 2 p.m. Saturday afternoon. That's where we're going to find out who the choice will be to replace Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Now, as I said yesterday and I said earlier today, I think the vote should take place after the election, not before it. I don't know what the timeline is going to be, but the president has said that he wants the vote to take place before the November 3rd election. I think it's smarter to campaign on it. Say, if you vote me into office, you get the Supreme Court. Because obviously in the Senate, we're going to have the votes to do it. However, if he is in fact going to get his way and get it voted on before November 3rd, it changes a little bit the dynamics of the election. It could be negative, it could be positive. Let's talk through this. Assuming it's Amy Coney Barrett, judge who a lot of folks like, a lot of folks have been rallying for. Let's say this conservative judge replaces the progressive Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Does the election then come down to whether or not Republicans and independents want to reward President Trump for yet another issue that the president has promised to fulfill, having fulfilled it? Does he get the reward? Or does it lead to less people feeling like they should wait in line to vote? Because, hey, the big thing that they really truly cared about, they already got. There were a lot of people who back in 2016, what they did was they held their nose because they didn't like the way President Trump campaigned. They didn't like some of the language he used. They didn't like the tweets. But they said, you know what? The most important issue to me is the Supreme Court justice pick. So remember, they were trying to replace Antonin Scalia. And at the time, you had Republicans and some independents saying to themselves, hey, I want to make sure that Scalia is not replaced by a progressive. I will hold my nose and vote for Donald Trump. And obviously, it paid off. If those same people are out there and they are still equally interested in voting for Trump to maintain a sane Supreme Court, and in this case, again, replacing a progressive with a conservative, if you've already given them that win, do they still hold their nose and vote for Donald Trump? Assuming nothing has changed for that voter since 2016. Do they still do that? I don't know if they do. Now, on the other hand, presumably, Joe Biden right now, his campaign is working overtime to energize not just the base of the Progressive Party, but women in particular, saying that Roe v. Wade will be overturned if you get this justice in place. And we need to fight very, very hard to ensure that they don't. Vote for me, vote for me, vote for me. If the justice that they believe is going to help overturn Roe v. Wade gets actually put on the court, do they then say, oh, screw it, I'm not even going to vote, I'm done? Are they disillusioned? Does it hurt? Or do they say, I'm going to exact a level of revenge that you will have never expected to see coming? We're going to take over the Senate. And they show up in droves to kick out Martha McSally in Arizona, Tom Tillis, the incumbent in North Carolina. Do they do that? I don't know. It's a little bit of a gamble. It's a little bit of a gamble. But we're going to find out soon, because today Mitt Romney comes out and says, yeah, I'm the Senator number 50 who is on the record saying, go ahead, I will vote. I will not stand in the way of bringing someone to the House floor. Now, Democrats, of course, are upset. They're ticked off. Representative Hakeem Jeffries says the Senate majority has been overstepping their power.
The reality of the political landscape in front of us is that we have an out-of-control president and a Senate majority that is drunk on power. And we remain committed to trying to arrive at the common ground necessary to get something done for the American people. But
stop them for a second. They're drunk on power, and they've been working really, really hard on behalf of the American people, says the guy who was one of the leaders of the effort to impeach the president for non-criminal acts. You guys at the time, though, weren't drunk on power.
It has to be meaningful.
Uh-huh.
It can't simply be a White House press release that Donald Trump can promote at his rallies, but does nothing to alleviate the pain, suffering, and death being experienced by the American people in the midst of a pandemic.
You're shifting the conversation. I got it. Okay. I don't know if that's a moving argument. I don't know if that's a moving argument. I do know that Democrats do have the opportunity to get their base even more riled up, because they clearly were dealing with some problems with the Joe Biden campaign, and that people might hate Donald Trump on the left, but they don't love Joe Biden. Right? There's no one out there that I've seen, certainly not in meaningful numbers, who comes out there and says, "I am so pumped about Joe Biden. I've never been more excited about a candidate before in my life." You do get that for Donald Trump. You get hardcore people wearing their MAGA hats, marching around, supporting President Trump with their American flags. They're showing up to these huge rallies. He's got a lot of that support. The people who love Donald Trump love Donald Trump. He's got way more people who love him than Joe Biden. Seriously, Producer Peyton, in the now 25-year-old category of millennials, do you know anyone who's a liberal who's hardcore excited about Joe Biden?
No.
Vote for Joe Biden.
Yes, they are going to vote
they say
for Joe
that.
Biden.
We'll see. But they're not excited. And people who are not excited tend not to vote. At least of the group of potential voters, there's going to be a percentage that matters that choose not to vote. They forget, and then they don't really care. Can the lack of excitement be overcome now? Because now you've got a whole bunch of people who are concerned about the Supreme Court. And from a Democratic perspective, if you're a Democrat, if you're a liberal, you should be concerned. Because the Supreme Court is going to go towards the conservatives in a way that you're not going to be able to overturn. Now, part of me also, as we're having these conversations about the strategy behind this, because very clearly, if they go ahead and move forward and vote beforehand, you can get enough people to kick McSally out of office, Tillis out of office, Joni Ernst out of office, these Republicans, and then all of a sudden the Senate goes to the Democrats. Well, at that point, will it have been worth getting this Supreme Court? Probably. Getting a Supreme Court to ideologically align with your side, that's worth a lot. Which is why now you've got the Democrats talking about adding justices to the Supreme Court. Stacking the courts, which is so disturbing for them to say. So disturbing for them to say. Because what they're essentially admitting is, yeah, if we don't get our way after a court case, we're just gonna put more justices on the bench who agree with us politically. As if that's a argument that the country is going to look and say, yeah, that's the right thing to do. I have to imagine, even Democrats look at that, like your average Democratic voter says, well, I mean, that's not fair. You're really going to do that? And if you're going to do that, you do understand that at some point the Senate then is going to get back into the control of the Republican Party. And at the same time, we're going to get a president who is a Republican. Can't they then stack the Supreme Court themselves to even everything out? So is that what we're going to do? We're now going to decide on cases based on who controls the Senate and the presidency. Is that really what this country is all about? That's what you want to do? It is absolutely absurd. And behind all of this is another talking point that, again, I do think is important. We talked a little bit about it yesterday. Joe Biden finally talked about it. President Trump has hit rightfully the Biden campaign for not actually putting out a list of who he's considering to be on the Supreme Court. President Trump has done it twice now. When he was running as a candidate, he put out a list. And then just recently, he updated the list a week and a half, 2 weeks ago. And so a reporter asked Joe Biden, hey, do we have the right, do voters have the right to actually know who's on your shortlist?
No, they don't, but they will. If I'm elected, they'll know in plenty of time.
That is a horrible answer. That is a horrible answer. It's horrible because we, of course, have the right to know. We absolutely have the right to know. We have the right to know anything that we deem we have the right to know when we're talking about public service. You would work for the American people. Number two, it's a horrible answer because, again, it just plays into the strategy. Now all Trump has to do, and I'm sure he's doing it tonight, he's at a rally right now in Pennsylvania, and he's going to continue to do it at rallies and in front of interviewers, and he's certainly going to do it on the debate stage. All he has to do is say the reason why he doesn't want to tell you is on that shortlist because they're all crazy socialists, which is why you need to vote for me. Because we're going to keep the crazy socialists away from the courts. And Joe Biden, who doesn't want to tick off the crazy socialists, the base of the Democratic Party, do you think that he's going to come out and say, oh no, they're not going to be crazy socialists? He's not going to say that because then the base gets upset. He's put himself in a really horrible position. And so President Trump is going to continue to take advantage of that. You're listening to the Jason Rand Show. When we come back, we're going to check in with the state treasurer, Dwayne Davidson. He is in a tough re-election campaign where he's trailing some. What's not making it any easier is that his opponent keeps lying. We're going to talk about it when we come back. Find me on Twitter, twitter.com/JasonRants. Let's find out what else is trending.
What's trending? Let's get political.
The race for treasurer is heating up after a series of temper tantrums coming from Democrat Mike Pelliciotti. He hopes to oust the state treasurer, Dwayne Davidson, Republican, who joins me now. Dwayne, welcome back to the show. It's been a while.
Thank you. Thank you for having me today.
So Pelliciotti is essentially claiming that you've been an absent treasurer, that you're not releasing your full calendar, which presumably he thinks is going to make his point. So what say you?
Oh, it's all those things are unfounded. Number one, the calendar situation is totally unfounded. To prove the point, I've actually put my calendar, what was released to him, has already been released to him. My entire four-year calendar for everybody to review, it's on my website. It's on my campaign website. So I made it available to everybody, and I'm pointing to all the editorial boards from now on that we go to. There it is.
And why do you think that that pushes back at the claims he makes?
He just continues to try to find, the guy has nothing on me. It's amazing. I hate to, you know, be so boastful, and I'm going to put a big disclaimer on this, that I've been able to do a lot of the accomplishments with the help of an excellent staff. But we have had a very, very good 4 years of Treasury management. And there is not much to go on here for, and you know, I'm sorry that opposition has such trouble finding things to run against me on. So they make things up. And this is one of the things that he's doing, is he's making this up. And he's also trying to paint that, I've had to talk about this so much, it's just ridiculous, because he just brings this up over and over and mm-hmm. over again. But I'm derelict on my duties because I've missed these meetings. What he's failing to point out is, number one, this is the norm of the office, all elected offices, that you deputize people to be these meetings for you. I did attend practically every committee that the treasurer has a position on. When I first came to office, I was there to familiarize myself with the operation. I attended, and then I found people that are on my staff that has expertise. Let me just, if I can, just give me a couple of the person I created a department of financial literacy to advocate for financial literacy to be taught in schools, and other measures like a financial literacy portal that homeschoolers and other people use, that's on my website. I took that manager, who happens to be a woman that has two kids in school, two school-aged kids, that's a manager of financial literacy, and I put that person on the GET committee. as a Treasury representative on the GET committee. I still oversee all the decisions made. She doesn't make any votes that surprise me. We talk about every meeting before and after. But what she does is she brings a wealth of knowledge from what she experiences in her job as in charge of that department. She brings that to that committee, which means that they don't only have me still as the elected official, as the oversight, but they also have this individual with all this individual expertise. The same goes for the investment board and for the housing finance. I've got a gentleman that is recognized nationally for his skills in tax-exempt debt, representing me there. I didn't hire them to represent me on board. They were already on staff.
Well, it just sounds like that most people probably don't know the ins and outs of how this office and, frankly, most offices work. And Mike Pelliciotti is taking advantage of that. And, of course, as someone who is the incumbent who has a really good track record, which, by the way, folks can find out about right now at davidson4wa.com. It's all spelled out, davidson4wa.com. People can see your track record, and yet at the same time in the primary, I mean, look, you trailed Pelliciotti by quite a lot. So what do you think is behind that result, given your track record, and what's the plan to make up for those votes on November 3rd?
It's purely partisan. We live in a fairly blue state. You know, we haven't had a Republican governor for some time. Hopefully, that can change. We live in a pretty blue state. It takes a lot to get elected and stay and reelected as a Republican. The odd thing about this job is I've been a Republican all my life and was a Republican county treasurer for four terms before coming here. But I have to say that the county treasurer position and the state treasurer position, I find it kind of odd that it's partisan anyway, really, quite frankly, because after the election, you're not really a policy setter as much as you are an elected administrator. And so it's more of a job that lends itself to what probably most people would regard as a nonpartisan, like a superintendent of public instruction. So, but it is partisan by constitution. They haven't changed it like they have changed some other positions over the years. And so while it stays partisan, in the state, he is running very much on the partisan label, and it got him some votes. I just hope to get the message out between now and Election Day that I do bring a lot of my conservative principles to the administration of the office. At the same time, I am a very respected person trying to engage both sides of the aisle in decision making. I was president of the County Treasurers Association when I was the county treasurer for three terms, representing both Democrat and a Republican.
You were just reappointed as the Banking Committee chair by a Democrat for the National Association of State Treasurers. I know you've worked closely with Oregon to allow banking for legal marijuana businesses in Washington State. So, I mean, you definitely have a tremendous background. We're fans of yours. We're encouraging every single person to make sure that you're voting for Dwayne Davidson for treasurer. He's a Republican who's got bipartisan support in a role that probably, to his point, should not be partisan. So, again, his website, davidson4wa.com. davidson4wa.com. Dwayne Davidson, thank you so much for stopping by. I really appreciate it.
Hey, thank you so much for the time, Jason. I really, really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Again, davidson4wa.com. Make sure you go there. Make sure you're telling all your friends to vote for Dwayne Davidson. You're listening to The Jason Rancho. When we come back, more coverage of the crazy world of politics. Jason Rancho live on this Tuesday afternoon. Three NFL head coaches, including Pete Carroll of the Seahawks, they got fined $100,000 each because they didn't wear masks on the sidelines during the games over the weekend. The other two coaches are Vic Fangio of Denver and Kyle Shanahan over in San Francisco. Now, in addition to the $100,000 fine, according to ESPN, each team also fined $250,000. I have some thoughts.
Of course you do. It's a radio show. I would love to hear them.
The players themselves do not wear masks on the sidelines.
Correct.
The coach and their staff spend every waking moment next to the players.
Correct.
So if the players don't have to wear a mask, and they're going through protocols to make sure that they're not playing while sick, why then can't the coaches choose not to wear a mask?
I think you're looking for the term virtue signaling is happening on the NFL sidelines.
And what do I hate more than anything?
Probably virtue signaling.
Virtue signaling. I mean, myself, I hit myself first. But then number two is virtue signaling. They want them to wear the mask, not because it makes sense, but because it could potentially send a message to the kids who are watching and the adults to wear masks too. Which would make sense if the players themselves were wearing masks. One dude surrounded by a bunch of people not wearing masks, that one dude wearing the mask, that's not a good virtue signal.
No, it's bad.
And the NFL, I just don't understand it.
The NFL's full of dumb fines. This is what the NFL does. It was only a matter of time, and now they just made a bunch of money off of three coaches.
So, Pete Carroll, the funny thing is, when I saw some of the, I didn't watch the whole thing, when I was watching some of it, I did notice he was not wearing a mask. But I also noticed that Bill Belichick was miswearing his mask. It was only covering, like, his nose. His mouth, it was like a beak.
It was literally the smallest mask that I've ever seen, and at no point...
Well, he has a fat head.
But at no point could it ever cover both his nose and his mouth at the same time. It was one or the other.
Now, I don't know if that was him sending a message to the league, like in protest, and he does the bare minimum, so no one... You could just be like, I didn't realize I was wearing it wrong. My bad. He looked like an idiot.
It's week two. He wore a standard mask that worked all of last week. And then week two, he shows up with the little bird beak thing.
But it was weird, right?
He
should get fined.
Sure.
Of all the people who should get fined, it should be him.
Sure, fine him. The NFL's fined him a lot.
So the NFL, they have a standard that they're following across the league to ensure safety amongst the players. Correct?
Correct.
And beyond that, there is a general policy that the individual teams have, I'm assuming to the players, saying, hey, obviously we're not going home with you and we're not going to be following you and chaperoning you this entire time, but we expect that you're going to create some form of a bubble. You're not going out to parties, you're not hanging out and doing things other than with us because we want to make sure that no one gets the coronavirus.
Yes.
We want to make sure that your spouses and the women you're cheating on your spouses with, and this is just in a general sense for sports. We want to make sure that you guys are all, again, just being responsible. We're not going to follow the family around. We're not going to question your spouse to see if they've been doing things we told you not to do, but we're generally expecting that of you, right? So, assuming they're following the guidance and the league and any individual team, be it the Seahawks or the Patriots or whomever, are following the guidelines at the stadiums and at the facilities, my assumption is the coaches are also doing that. Arguably, the coaches are doing it better than the actual players who aren't staying at the facilities and in the offices late into the evening going over tape the way the coaches are doing it. Right? The coaches are probably working late into the evening, then they're going home, and they're doing more work there. So they're already most likely in the category of being very, very, very safe. So if everyone's being safe, and you are regularly testing folks for COVID, what's the problem here? It doesn't exist.
There isn't one.
Now, in soccer, what I find interesting is that the players do wear the masks. It's a little bit different because you don't have players coming on and off the pitch the entire time. You're hanging out until you get called in to sub, right? But you could still cover faces if you wanted on the sidelines with the two teams, which they choose not to do. So this is absolutely absurd.
It's the way for the NFL to make money. They've been doing stupid fines since day one.
Ironically, if you beat up a spouse for not wearing the mask, the NFL will only fine you for not wearing the mask.
Yeah, and they'll suspend you at the first, and then you appeal, and then they'll just be like, okay, cool, you appealed it.
Then we'll say, okay, this appeal's going to go a long way. By the time it comes around, people will have forgotten about the story. Doesn't matter if you're beating a spouse or a puppy, or you got into a car accident because you were high at the time, or you decided to rob 10 banks. Whatever it is, people will forget. We're just going to give you a pass. That's the NFL.
Yeah, the NFL's the worst. They fined Brian Urlacher $100K for wearing a hat that was not branded by the NFL. It was a vitamin water hat.
I know who Brian Urlacher is. I know who he is. However, there might be some other people listening who don't know. And I don't want to show you up because people might think you don't actually know who he plays for. So I will let you.
But you know who Brian Urlacher is.
Yes.
And you would never not know that Brian Urlacher is a former linebacker for the Chicago Bears. Who retired a few
years
back
ago.
And he was a very, very good NFL player.
NFL player.
See?
Yes.
You nailed
it. I'm glad you did it.
Yeah. Hopefully. You know exactly who Brian Urlacher is.
Brian Urlacher. Spelled with a U.
Yes.
And an Urlacher.
Urlacher, yes.
Yeah. So things are not going so well for the businesses around CenturyLink, since we're talking about the Seahawks. You've got restaurants and bars that usually are completely packed because of game day. But now that they're not allowing people into the stadium, they are significantly less packed. Here's Farshid Varamini talking with King Five. He's the owner of People's Burger on Occidental Avenue.
Typically, I'd be up at 3 a.m. and be down here by 4. Today, I woke up around 8, came down around 9:30, 10. So, not to mention, looking around, there's obviously you don't have the excitement and the energy and the noise, the people. Typically, you can't see the streets.
Actually, that sounds like he's much better off. He doesn't have to get up at 4 a.m.?
Yeah.
Is that what he said?
I have a feeling his bar and restaurant is not making as much money as...
Yeah, but you don't have to get up at 4 a.m.
Yeah, you know what? I'm sure that guy wants to continue to provide for his family adequately.
I mean, that's an assumption. You know what they say about making assumptions. I will say what I find curious about this is that there are still some other restaurants that are, in fact, filled with people.
You can still see the pride of the Seahawks because of all the people that are still here. So
she's in a restaurant.
Interesting that there's not a game you can attend, but there's still pride no matter what.
So they're not staying away from the crowds. They're just staying away from a smaller venue. They're staying away from the larger venue for a smaller one.
And they're not wearing masks because they're stuffing their pie holes with food.
Yeah, that's kind of funny. You're listening to the Jason Rancho. When we come back, how did Washington State prepare financially for the pandemic or really any crisis? Not well. We'll tell you how and why when we come back. Show on AM 770 KTTH and 94.5 FM on the Greater East Side. Washington State was financially unprepared for a crisis like COVID, or really any crisis. That according to Truth in Accounting, a financial watchdog group. They've got a new report out, and it says Governor Jay Inslee and Washington State, they get a D for the work that I suppose went into preparing for some kind of crisis. Joining me on the line is the CEO and the founder of Truth in Accounting, Sheila Weinberg. Sheila, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for covering this important topic.
It's incredibly important. So take us through exactly what the findings were.
Well, what we found, as you mentioned, is the state received a D. We determined that because we determined that each taxpayer's burden, which is each taxpayer's share of the state's debt, is $6,100. The state's debt, as we calculated, is $17.2 billion. And so that's why we gave the state a D grade.
So let's unpack some of those numbers. First, how do you determine that number?
Okay, what we do is we go to the state's audited financial statements. We don't do their budgets because we consider those are just political math. It's very hard. Those are almost impossible to analyze. The audited financial statements are a little bit easier to analyze, but still difficult. And we look at the assets that the state reports and the bills, including their unfunded pensions and their unfunded retiree health care liabilities, and compare the assets that the state has available to those bills that they have accumulated to date.
So then, obviously, you compare all the numbers and the individual taxpayer burden across all 50 states. You've got us listed, like you said, at 6,100. So does that mean the average person here will end up having to pay an additional $6,100?
Yes, it's a per taxpayer number, not a per person. But it's approximately per household. This represents future taxes that somebody will have to pay, and they won't receive any government services or benefits for those taxes because that money was already spent in the past, and they're just paying for the bills that have been accumulated so far.
And this, of course, is where some of the politicking does come into play, because you'll have Democrats in particular saying we need to raise tax rates on the wealthy to lower this number on individual taxpayers. You've got some who are basically saying we're going to wait and see what the Congress is going to give us as far as some kind of financial package. And that could, of course, then lower that number. But at the end of the day, taxpayers in some way, shape, or form will be paying for this.
Yeah, it will be either the taxpayers throughout the country, including people in Washington, or people in Washington individually, if Congress doesn't come through, doesn't decide to give additional money to the states. And we say if they're going to give money to the states, then let's put some conditions on it. And the major one condition would be is, if you have a balanced budget requirement, you need to use good accounting and go ahead and truly balance your budget instead of accumulating $17.2 billion of debt while you have been balancing your budget, theoretically.
So do you take the position that the reason why we were hit so hard and seemed unprepared is just bad accounting?
Well, it's bad accounting that they were, again, saying that they were balancing their budget. So instead of in the past living within their means, and that's why you have a balanced budget requirement, they used accounting gimmicks to either inflate their revenue or to deflate their expenses. For example, compensation cost, they used pensions to defer some of that instead of paying and funding that as they went along.
What's just astonishing here is that Washington State, we just had record revenues coming into the coffers, record revenues, but they very clearly didn't save all that much money, and they just kind of earmarked it.
Yeah, and we do have $14.3 billion of what the government calls restricted assets. So that amount might be included in those restricted assets, and we don't include that in our analysis because that can't be used to pay the bills that they've already accumulated.
If you're just joining me, I'm talking with the CEO and founder of Truth in Accounting, Sheila Weinberg. The website, truthinaccounting.org, truthinaccounting.org. We're talking about a new report that gives Washington State a D for being unprepared for a crisis like COVID. Now, we say like COVID because, generally speaking, no one will anticipate a pandemic, certainly not like this one. But what planning can and should go into sort of the work that state legislators do to anticipate some kind of crisis?
Well, there is some form of crisis. When the Great Recession happened, that was something we didn't expect. And then there was, things before that, the dot-com bubble. There seems to be, unfortunately, crisis every about 7 years. And states, at a minimum should be living up to their balanced budget requirements. Why does the state have a balanced budget requirement? So they don't go into debt, so they can be prepared when crisis happens, and so that the taxpayers can hold their elected officials accountable for their spending. But instead, they use these accounting gimmicks when they budget to balance the budget but go into debt at the same time. So we would say the very first step is let's truly balance our budget. Let's fully fund our pensions instead of pushing that cost onto future taxpayers.
So how does Washington State compare to the others?
So we give the states grades, and we do the grading system based upon that that you're passing if you really do truly balance your budget. So, and if you truly balance your budget, then you don't have any money that you've pushed, bills that you've pushed on to future taxpayers. So your taxpayer burden, the per taxpayer amount, should be zero. So any state that has a zero, and we give them a little bit of a break, a zero to a $5,000 taxpayer burden, we give them a C. And obviously Washington State got a D. We also rank the states by numbers, and Washington State is kind of in the middle of the pack. They're 27th out of 50 states in the whole pack of states.
Who did the best?
Alaska actually did the best, but that's because Alaska we do a comprehensive holistic approach. So we look at all of the assets that a state has available. And Alaska does have two permanent funds, two true rainy day funds, not like some states that, quote, have rainy day funds but are in debt at the same time. But Alaska has two permanent funds. One of them that is a pure permanent fund cannot be touched by law, but they do have another fund that is available to be used. So they have a lot of these assets that, you know, investments that they could use to pay their pensions. Their pensions may not be funded as well as some of the states, but they do have that cash available. But up in Alaska, they're having great budget battles right now because nobody wants to even to tap into those funds at all. So they're trying to, you know, figure out how to get through this pandemic without tapping into either one of those funds.
Yeah. So last question for you. When you looked at all the data, did you catch any ideological trends? Do Republicans versus Democrats do any better? Does it not really play into any of this and it's just sort of all over the board?
We do have a website called Data -z.org, and that allows people to go in and look at data points like that. You know, we look at, you know, we have our financial data, but it also has the data of various, political slants. But we try to stay neutral. We have had people look at our database, and they have found that governments that are lean more to Democratic sides are in worse financial shape than than the Republicans. Leaning states. Some of that also has to do where Democratic states seem to be urban states, but they also urban areas and also states that are old have been in the union longer. We do find that states that have been in the union longer also are in worse financial shape.
Well, there you go. If you want to read this report and see how Washington did across or in comparison to some of the other states, go to truthinaccounting.org. We've been talking with their CEO and founder, Sheila Weinberg. Sheila, thank you so much for stopping by.
Yeah, and they can go to Data Z to just look at Washington by itself.
There you go. Again, Data Z or, of course, truthinaccounting.org. You've been listening to The Jason Rancho. Thank you so much for tuning in. Really, really do appreciate it. Coming up next, Ben Shapiro, right here on KTTH.